ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Good evening and welcome to our broadcast. It's really nice to be with all of you here tonight. And good to see some names that I recognize already. We're going to take some time tonight to go through some important questions. As I like to say, questions are the answer. Questions are like hooks. They open for us the deeper topics that help us to really go into the mysteries of the world. In fact, one should become a master asker, as a great teacher once told me. So many of you have been sending in questions through the website at vaisheshikadas.com, and we've been collecting them over time. There's quite a few, and we thank you very, very much for interacting and sending the questions in. They're very interesting and they're very helpful. So we're going to go through some of the questions tonight. And if you have questions and you're on Zoom or you're on Facebook and listening in tonight, feel free to also type in your questions live, and we'll try to take some of those as well. We're starting off with some of the questions that have come in through the website. And one of them is something that is a frequently asked question. How can one manage the multiple pressures and demands of life without losing balance? That's something that people are feeling the weight of every day, and that is multiple pressures. So, what are these pressures? We're in situations sometimes we're not even sure how much pressure we're under. There's a story about a frog. When he's put into a dish of water and then the water gradually heats up, he doesn't even notice it until it gets too hot for him to live. So in the same way, if we're not careful and we allow pressures to add up in our lives, then we can suddenly feel like we're not even human and we can forget the purpose of life. It's important to stop at intervals and introspect and actually look and see what kinds of things are going on inside. This is very helpful for balancing, because balance happens from the inside out. When I'm more aware of what's actually inside, and I'm able to get a little perspective to see that thoughts are energy and they're moving through my mental system all the time, then I can become aware that I have a choice to deal with them or to not deal with them according to their importance. Have you ever found that some of the greatest pressures you have in your life are things that are not actually urgent and not actually important? Nonetheless, I make a big deal out of them and I suffer because of it. So looking within and seeing what are actually the individual pressures that are bothering me, and then prioritizing them, how important are they? That really helps. The other thing that helps to keep balance in life is to have clear goals. And I've done this experiment many times in live seminars. We ask everybody in the audience to stand up. And then we ask everyone to stand on one leg. And of course, it's not that hard to balance on one leg, but one does notice that the muscles in the leg are twitching and holding you, bringing you back into the center. So that's not so hard. And everyone puts their foot down. Then we ask everyone to do it again. And this time, close your eyes. So now, balancing on one leg with your eyes closed becomes a little more difficult. And people go tipping all over the room. So after we open our eyes and sit down, we talk about the importance of having some vision. Because if I know which direction I'm going, I'm actually really excited about the direction I'm going because I have a clear goal. Then the pressures and the various influences that are coming into my life at every minute become less noticeable, or they don't have that much effect on me because I have a clear idea that I'm going from here to a really good destination. And the things, the obstacles that come up in my life, the pressures, actually make it worth it. They help me along the way because a little bit of pressure helps me to stay on my toes. And I can handle it when I know where I'm going. So taking time to introspect, prioritizing what are my real pressures, why are they affecting me, looking at them carefully and getting a little distance from them, and also having a clear goal about which way I'm going is very important. Another question someone just wrote in. How do you deal with fear? So in the ancient wisdom literature, the Srimad Bhagavatam, which talks about the practice of bhakti yoga, which is the yoga of gratitude. The idea of fear is given very specific definition. In Sanskrit, it's called bhayam. And the verse that describes it says, bhayam syat, or fear arises when I lose track of my real identity. So it says, bhayam dvitiya, that my real identity is something that is beyond just the physical body or the subtle mind. I have an identity that is spiritual. In other words, I'm an entity that has its spiritual identity. I'm within a body and mind, which I'm using as a vehicle. When I misidentify myself as being the mind or the body, says the verse, that's when I start to feel fear. And here's why. The body and mind are temporary, and I'm not. The stuff that I'm made of is actually indestructible. It goes on even after the body diminishes, even as the body's changing. The entity that I am stays the same. But if I identify with the outside changing world, the mind, which is constantly churning, and the body, which is many times degrading or not living up to my expectations, and I think that's me, and that's happening to me, then I get in great anxiety. So the verse recommends the remedy, which is to actually understand yourself. Who am I? Am I the body and the mind, or am I something else? Am I the witness that's beyond the body and the mind? When I can actually notice that I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my body, I'm witnessing the body, I'm witnessing my thoughts, and therefore I'm the onlooker, I'm not actually the body. In such a case, I can feel fearless. Otherwise, I get into the whirlpool of material thought, and identification with the physical world necessarily brings fear, because the biggest fear of all is the fear of non-existence, that at some point I will cease to exist and I have to leave behind everything that I have. So that is the definition given by the wisdom literature. And it sounds philosophical, but it's very practical at the same time. Have you ever had somebody come up to you and say, you look tired? How do you feel? And suddenly you look in the mirror and you think, oh, I feel tired. Somebody might say, oh, you look terrible. What happened to you? Then suddenly you start to feel terrible. If someone walks up to you and say, you look spiritual, you might have a moment of clarity where you think, oh, actually I am spiritual. And this is the realm of actual alignment, of understanding our real nature. When one has that, one can overcome fear. These are great questions. Thank you very much, everyone, for pouring them in here. We're trying to handle them as they come. And let's see. Here's one. How should couples handle it when they follow different spiritual practices? In particular, when some of the actions that should not be performed, like eating meat, intoxication. So this is very common because couples, people who live together, various places around the world, are inevitably going to have slightly different lifestyles and paths. I see it all the time. Sometimes one or the other partner is going in one way and the other one's going in another direction. So one thing I can tell you for sure that I've seen over and over again, and that is that if you try to force your partner to follow your path and tell him or her that you have to do it this way, then the old adage that whatever you resist persists comes into play almost immediately. First of all, people don't like to be told what to do. I've noticed that throughout my life, that I didn't like to be told what to do when I was a kid or in school and so on. And I've noticed it with other people too. And especially when it comes to spiritual values. So what is the solution? Oddly enough, it's to be a little bit tolerant and to lead by example. Rather than trying to push your partner into your practice, which will inevitably lead them to go the other way in most cases, unless you're dealing with a very, very rare person. It's better to set a good example and show how your path, your spiritual practice, is actually clean and clarifying and beneficial. If anybody sees somebody else performing activities or engaging in a lifestyle that's actually beautiful and looks beneficial, they get attracted. And if you allow them some space and some time and even accommodate whatever they need to do in their life, then most likely, and I've seen this many times, the couple who has holding back or was not interested in practicing the same kind of disciplines or spiritual life that you are, they oftentimes become attracted and they'll want to follow it too. But definitely don't push people because it backfires. They'll go the other way. That was a great question from Anonymous. Thank you, Anonymous, for offering that. And here's one from Mr. Vamshuli, who writes, when faced with severe and continual financial challenges, what should we do? Should we simply be peaceful with the faith that whatever is destined would reach us and then go on doing whatever our duty is, whatever we're supposed to do? Or should we resort to practical steps to gain wealth, like working harder, shifting to new careers or places, making astrological remedies, etc.? Kindly steer us towards spiritual solutions to these material problems. Well, answering from the wisdom literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, the great teacher, Narada Muni, points out that nobody invites trouble into their life. At least nobody I know. Mostly I notice that people put up good luck charms. They ask in their prayers that some good thing comes into their life. Nobody's sitting home praying that disaster comes to their doorstep. But this great teacher, Narada, points out that reversals of fortune come anyway, even if we don't invite them. They naturally flow into our life from time to time, maybe not perpetually, sometimes more than at other times. So he says, you should also understand that just as bad things come into your life uninvited and without your expecting them to come, he said, good things will come too. And this, he says, is because we have some momentum already, because all of us live in a continuum. We're moving not just in this life from our youth to our adolescence and into middle age and old age. But as the Bhagavad Gita, the great treatise on yoga, says, we're actually moving from one lifetime to the next. A lifetime is defined as one compartmentalized area of consciousness where we take on one body and then give it up and then take on another body. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Ukramantam stitam vapi bunjanam vagunanvitam vimudanana pashanti pashanti jnana chakshusha. If somebody's trained in knowledge, they'll see very clearly that we're passing from one life to the next. The point is that we are carrying with us the results of our previous activities. And therefore, when we come into this life, so many different good or bad things come to us. And they may seem inordinate. They may seem or be unexpected. However, the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, the great yoga wisdom literature, say, expect the unexpected. They will come to you whether you invite them or not. Having said that, it makes sense that we live as balanced a life as possible. As when it comes to financial matters, do your due diligence. Do whatever you have to do in order to keep yourself prepared so that you can live a financially successful life. But after you do your due diligence, don't break your head on the rock, trying to do more and more and more, because there is a natural way in which you'll go through phases in your life when good things come and bad things come. And if you're doing your due diligence, you shouldn't mind too much, or you should be tolerant when these things come. Otherwise, everyone would be wealthy. If you could just work two jobs or work harder or shift careers or try astrological remedies, everyone would be wealthy. And you'll notice that sometimes people work harder and they don't make more, and sometimes people work less and they make more money. Hopefully that gives you a few thoughts that will be helpful. Let's see. Thank you very much. Ronnie has written in. Ronnie says, some people are in a long-term coma for years. Is it right to continue life? How does the soul feel trapped in an almost dead body? What is the reason for such a state? Wow, great questions, Ronnie. Thank you very much. Well, it's true. Some people are in long-term coma for years. In fact, in the news recently, there have been a few cases where people were in long-term comas and then they came out of them. I've actually seen for myself someone who was in a coma, and I went with a group of others to visit this person, and the doctor said, oh, she can't hear you. One in our group said, how do you know? And later, after we had done some chanting and some mantras, she actually responded and came out of her coma. So the doctor was surprised, and so were we. But we're seeing these things around the world, hearing about people coming out of comas. So the wisdom literatures say that as long as one can continue life, if you have some control over it, it's important to try to maintain your life, that is, to stay in the present body, because it's a very rare attainment to get a human body, and you can use it for self-realization, and therefore you should try to do what you can to stay alive. The soul, she asks, how does the soul feel trapped in an almost dead body? Well, I do know that I have a friend who had a stroke and the body shut down. And he was telling me after he recovered that he felt like he was inside a dark tunnel and he was simply lost. He realized he was inside a body, but he couldn't do anything about it. And he felt trapped. As far as coma victims go, I haven't read lots of literature about it, but the fact is that there are various states of consciousness that are mentioned in the wisdom literatures. And in many cases, there's dreamless sleep. In other words, we're not even aware of our dreams at that point. And there is also dreaming consciousness. The soul, oftentimes when people come out of comas, they say that they were aware of people around them and so forth, but it really is dependent on the case. It's a case-by-case basis. So the last part of the question from Ronnie is, what is the reason for such a state? So that's a very esoteric question. But according to the wisdom literatures, there is a way in which sometimes we get suspended when we're moving through various bodies. And in some cases, there hasn't been a final destination set for the next body, for the person in this body. And so there's some waiting period. And also it's due to various other kinds of karma from previous lives, that we all go through various states of consciousness, and those can be taken as a learning period. So it is really a case-to-case basis about comas and how long to maintain life. There are various assertions that can be made through medical science to understand how alive the brain is, what how one is will be able to actually come back to consciousness after being in a coma. So one has to consider all those things. Here's another question that came in from Sumi. How should we handle grief? So there have been much written about grief, and it actually is described as a process. There are various levels to the grieving process. And this happens on a subtle level, that we have to process certain kinds of events in our lives that are very traumatic. When we cut ourselves physically, blood comes out and we'll feel some pain, and it takes time to heal. And in the same way, when we're injured internally, emotionally, it takes time to heal. The best advice that I've read is give yourself time to grieve, because it's actually part of the process. And also as you're grieving, realize how much deep emotion you actually have. We are sentient beings. That means we have feelings. Notice them. See how deep they actually are. In the practice of bhakti, we don't shut off our emotions, but we actually notice that they are real. And ultimately, those emotions are what connect us to our original divine source. So the grieving process, observing it, allowing oneself to go through it, can actually awaken us to understand a little bit more about our real nature. And there's a lot you can read about the grieving process. I recommend that you look into it, because during these times, you can actually find deeper learning. It's called times in your life when you can see more about your real self. Thank you very much, Sumi, for that question. Now, here's a practical one: how to organize one's life. So there are many things written about this, because obviously it doesn't happen by itself. If you leave things to their own devices, then generally there's a process of entropy. They fall apart rather than come together. So To be successful in any endeavor, organization is important. And one of the principles that I found to be very important in organization is to have a couple of mantras. One of them is a place for everything and everything in its place. When you take time to make a place for everything and put everything in its place, your life is less cluttered and you know where it is. You also have time to focus when you know everything's in its right place. Another tip, and this is something I learned many years ago, that if you sit down with a pad of paper, like a legal pad, so you have a little extra room to write, and a pen, and you decide, what do I actually want in my life? As a human being, you have this power to actually be imaginative. You can also be self-directing. And if you sit down with a pad of paper and a pen and just close all the doors, put a sign on your door, do not disturb, turn off all your electronic devices, and then think about it. What do I really want? The great speaker Jim Rohn used to say, it's really easy to set goals. There's only two parts. One is decide what you want, and the second is write it down. It's an amazing, magical process that happens after that. As soon as you decide, actually, I want this particular thing. I have a goal in my life. And then you write it down. It starts to manifest from a subtle level, and then it starts to go to the grosser level. The grosser level being the ink on the paper. It starts to manifest. This is the first stage because, as the saying goes in Alice in Wonderland, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And then what's the point of organizing, or why would you even think of organizing if you don't have somewhere to go? So that's the first step. Have a vision for your life and have a goal and take some time. It's your life. You get to decide, what do you actually want? And once you write it down, your mind will start thinking of ways to go towards your goal. Then, of course, there's lots of ways in which you can organize those thoughts and the ideas. One thing that I've found to be very practical is every night before going to bed, take a little time to think about your next day. What do you want to do the next day? Because after all, everything happens and all progress comes to us by making moment-to-moment decisions. We're only ever working in the present. Now, before going to bed, realize that when you wake up in the morning, you're not the same person. You go to many faraway places in your dreams, and you may wake up and then think, oh, who am I? Where am I and where am I going? But if the night before you actually take time to organize your desk, put out those things that you want to work on in the morning, write down a few thoughts about, here are the first three things I'm going to do when I wake up. When you wake up in the morning, you'll find, oh, there's an organized world around me. And maybe you'll even think, who did all this? And then you'll remember, oh, it was me. I organized the night before, and now I have somewhere to go when I'm waking up. There's a great book called, by David Allen, called Getting Things Done. I recommend that. He talks about organizing in such a way that you always know what your next step is. That plus setting clear goals for yourself and taking time every once in a while, like at least once a week, to look through and see how you're doing and evaluate how you're doing is very helpful in organizing your life. You'll find that many people go one whole week without thinking about how far they've come or what they're doing. Sometimes they can go a month, a year, 10 years, or 100 years and never even consider it, just floating with the current. So it's your life, decide what you want, write it down, and then decide what the next steps are. And you can start organizing. It feels really good. Let's see who else has written in here. these excellent questions. How to be content? This is a good question. Thank you very much for asking the question. Another anonymous question, how to be content? Well, let's think about it this way. The word content and content are the same. At least they're spelled the same way. The way I'm thinking of it is that each one of us is a container. So what do we contain? What's inside us? That's what determines how content we are. In other words, your content determines your contentment. Now, who gets to choose what kind of content is inside? Of course, we bring baggage from previous lives, as we already talked about. And in this life, we have made many choices to put certain kind of content into our ears, through our eyes. It goes all inside into our heart, and it has an effect on our life. Now, who gets to change the content? We do. If we decide that I'd like to have different content inside, then we can start rearranging. And now the wisdom literature say that the most important way that we're adding content to our hearts, to our minds, is what we listen to. In fact, there's a mantra in the ancient Vedas that says, anavriti shabdat. That means by sound, you can become uncovered. By sound, you become bound to the material world. And by sound, you can become liberated. It's the most subtle element and has the greatest effect on our consciousness and our level of contentment. If you start there, says the Bhagavad Gita, for example, by listening to spiritual content, knowledge, for instance, about the process of self-realization in yoga, by hearing it, even if you don't understand it completely at first, as it goes in your ears and into your heart, it starts a transformative process. You change from the inside out, just by listening. Now, what's amazing about this is when we're born, we get two free ears thrown in with the package of the human body. We get a free human body, and with it come two ears. These ears, if you look at them carefully in the mirror sometime, not for too long, you'll freak yourself out because they're kind of weird. They're like little satellite dishes. They're meant to catch sound and bring it in. The ancient wisdom literature says, especially for human beings, that apparatus, the ear, is meant to take in spiritual sound vibration. So there are mantras that are inherently spiritual. If you let them go in your ear, it will start the transformation process from the inside, and they will start to manifest in your outer world. And that is the secret to contentment. Because if you have the wrong content in your heart and mind, there's no way you're going to be content. So to be content, change your content. And to do that, change what you listen to. And if you don't like what you're listening to, feel free to cancel your subscription to whatever it is you're listening to. Don't subject yourself to sound that puts you in anxiety. That brings us to the 24-hour news cycle. Oftentimes people subscribe to all kinds of channels and they watch things that actually disturb their minds. They hear things that bring them sadness, and they hear about events that they can't really do anything about, but simply cause them pain. And then their mind and heart gets disturbed. So choose. Choose for yourself. What channel do you want to listen to? Thank you for that question. That was very beautiful. Now, here's another one Dave just wrote in. Thank you, Dave, for your question. He says, what is true freedom? Boy, is that a great question. Well, first thing is, it's something that people die for. A great philosopher, a statesman actually, said many years ago that the price of freedom is constant vigilance. You must be vigilant to maintain your freedom, because at least in the atmosphere of this world, you can lose your freedom. Some of the ways that we might not think about that we lose our freedom are mentioned in a very beautiful little book about the process of bhakti yoga. And it's called The Nectar of Instruction. It was written over 500 years ago by a master in the process of bhakti yoga named Rupa Goswami. And he says, Vacho vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jihva vegam, udarapasta vegam, itan vegam, yo vishaheta dhira, sarvamapi mam prithivim sa shishyat. And all that Sanskrit means that there are many urges that come to us from our senses. And when we learn to control the senses through the process of yoga, we actually become freer. This sounds counterintuitive, because oftentimes people think, if it feels good, do it. And you should be free to do whatever you want. Dogs run free, why can't we? The old song said, I think it was Bob Dylan. And the Bhagavad Gita says, if you learn to control your senses, you'll become freer. And so does Rupa Goswami, that the urges of the senses, which actually become our masters, give us less and less freedom. In another poem, these demands of the senses are described as bad masters. And the poet says, for how long and how many ways have I simply obeyed the urges of my senses? I've never questioned them. They never gave me time off, and they never gave me any leeway. They simply demanded more and more, no matter how much I gave them. And this is a poem about waking up to spiritual practice, in which the author says, no more. No longer am I going to follow the bad masters, the urges of my senses that simply to tell me to do this and that. I'm going to be self-determining, and I'm going to follow the process of bhakti yoga. And I'm going to direct my attention towards my original divine source and my highest good spiritually. This takes discipline and practice, but that is the way of freedom, actually, freedom from the senses. So much so that in the first verse I mentioned from Rupa Goswami, he says that the real masters of this world are the senses. They control everybody. And if someone can become self-determining, self-controlled, disciplined through the process of yoga, that person experiences a kind of freedom that brings happiness to the mind. It's called the Brahma-Bhuta platform, or the spiritual platform. And it says that the mind becomes happy. One then becomes free from the way in which the senses and mind are pulling on me at every second. I don't even notice it. Just like if you get on a wild horse and you don't care which way you're going, you won't notice it either so much. It's just when you tell him you want to go right or left and he doesn't agree. The senses are compared to wild horses. So when you can tame them through the process of yoga, especially through practicing some of the tenets of sattvic living, it means there are practices you can bring into your life in diet, in the way that you sleep, in the way that you keep your environment, the kinds of things that you listen to, and adding to that a very purely an inherent practice, which is spiritual, like mantra yoga, then what happens is you start to transform and you're no longer obligated by the senses to do what they want. You're free. So real freedom, according to the wisdom literatures, starts with yourself and your own self-control. So now, we're coming to the last section of our program tonight. And we're really happy that so many of you joined us from many places around the world and have written in through the website, vaisheshikadas.com, with many different kinds of questions. If you have written in, we've received hundreds of questions, so we're answering them diligently, and hopefully we'll get an answer to you quickly or soon enough. And if you have more questions, feel free to write in, and we'll answer them on a live Zoom, Facebook session like this. You can join us on the Zoom call or through Facebook and ask your questions. These kinds of questions, the questions that are about how to improve one's life, how to become more focused, how to organize, how to develop one's spiritual life and practice, are very important. And especially when we hear from the authoritative literatures, which are a source, a wellspring of knowledge about how to improve our lives, we can get some satisfaction. And this is actually mentioned in the literatures themselves, that by hearing and asking questions, hearing good answers, one can start to develop a sense of direction in one's own practice of spiritual life. So the last one I'll take is from Anantadev. He writes, "When you see a lot of wrong in the world but feel powerless and hopeless, what should you do?" When you see a lot of wrong in the world but feel powerless and hopeless, what should you do? What a great question. Stephen Covey gave us two circles. One of them is a wide circle that he calls the circle of concern. And within that wide circle, there's a smaller circle. This is our circle of influence. Not only Stephen Covey, but also Bhagavad Gita and the great wisdom literature say, find out what your actual circle of influence is and put your attention there. When you drift off into your circle of concern, that is the areas that you can't do anything about, you simply feel anxiety. Find what you can do something about right now. Oftentimes, it has more to do with helping oneself to become more centered, to develop more integrity. Because in any relationship, and the world is based on relationships ultimately, it's our own integrity that wins the day. And that allows us to actually be a positive influence on others and on situations that are dire. So start at home and find those things that you can actually do something about yourself. Most likely, starting with the disciplines we already talked about in the practice of bhakti yoga. We have just a couple minutes left. I would take this time to thank everybody for coming out tonight and for joining us for this broadcast in various places. Please stay tuned. We're dedicated to bringing you the best from the ancient bhakti wisdom literature that you can take home and practically use and improve your life. And look forward to seeing you again really soon. Thank you very, very much for joining. And we'll see you next time.